We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Every 10 years, the federal government counts the American population. And when this counting first began in 1790, it was designed to help in redrawing legislative districts. But over the years, it has really become something more. It's a snapshot of America at a particular time. And by looking at census data, maybe you can learn a little bit about where we've come from and think a little bit about where we are headed. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will be talking with historian Margo Anderson from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we'll try to talk a little bit about the origins of the census, maybe a little bit about how the survey has changed over time and who is counted. And questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest has done a lot of writing about this subject. She is the co-author of a book titled Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. It was last revised and updated in 2001. She is also editor of the Encyclopedia of the U.S. Census and author of the book The American Census, A Social History. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. We ask people to be brief in their comments so we can keep moving along, but people are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send your comments by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. And Professor Anderson, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes.
What I want to say here at the beginning is that we, on this program, we're not going to be able to answer specific questions related to, say, Champaign County, where we are, but that if people will go to our website, we do have a telephone number that people can call if they have questions related to the census. The local area office for East Central Illinois happens to be in Urbana, where we are. Also last night, one of the things that I did was I was in front of my computer and I typed in census 2010 Champaign, Illinois, and up comes a lot of data about Champaign. I don't think that if that doesn't reflect information that's being collected now, but I think it's some of the most current stuff that's there. And it's pretty interesting if you're interested in those kinds of numbers. So there are, we want to make sure that people know there are places to go, not this show, but there are places to go that they can get answers to all these various questions. Well, let me begin this way, because I think that for most people, the census is briefly on their agenda, you know, once every 10 years, and then it goes away and they don't think about it. Probably most people don't think about it. But I think maybe some people might be surprised that, in fact, as I said in the introduction, we've been doing this now every 10 years since 1790.
Right.
So it's been going on a long time. How and why did it get started?
Well, the decennial census, as it's called, in other words, every 10 years, was mandated by the federal constitution in 1787. Because when the 13 colonies rebelled against Britain and became the United States of America, they needed a mechanism to allocate political representation and initially also tax capacity among the colonies. And the original model that after the Revolution was each state got one vote, and that very quickly became unsatisfactory. So they rewrote the Constitution in 1787 and allocated representation in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College on a population count. And to do the population count, they had to mandate a census every 10 years. And so that's why we did it. The first one was right after the government was formed in 1790, and we've been doing it every 10 years ever since.
Mm-hmm. It's something that I'm sure we'll talk about. There, at least recently, has been some controversy about exactly how you do it,
mm-hmm.
and the limitations, and whether or not we miss people and who we
mm-hmm.
miss. And I think that there are some people who make this argument and say, well, you know, what the Constitution says is there's supposed to be a literal head count. And
mm-hmm.
the fact is, if you go all the way back to the beginning, you see, in fact, it's never been a literal head count.
Right. The Constitution as a document, really, to get the government going, didn't lay out the details of how to do it. I'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So the all it says in the Constitution is representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers. Right? And then it says you have to do it every 10 years. The next clause says the actual enumeration shall be made every 10 years, and every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. And that means, and the they there is Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress in 1790 had to sit down and figure out exactly what they had meant, you know, what the framers had meant about that. And so if you look to congressional debates and the law, you'll see right at the very outset that they confront these issues and they decide, for example, even though especially in the late 18th and early 19th century, most people didn't have political rights, right? So women and children and obviously slaves and indentured servants and unpropertied adult men, you know, they didn't vote or participate in the political process, but they were to be counted. So they essentially the rule of thumb has been to count everyone who is in the country. And you can see that, actually. You can actually go back to the congressional debates and see Congress do that. Congress at any time, by the way, could change that by going into the statute and changing the rules, if you will, that the Census Bureau follows.
But I guess I'm thinking about the fact that at that time we didn't count all the slaves, or at least
we didn't count. No, we did. We did.
But for the purpose of determining political districts, then they didn't all count.
No, we discounted
yes.
the total slave population of each state by 60% of the value of what was called the free population of each state. But we counted everybody.
Oh, so you need to make a distinction between counting and then what you do with the
right, exactly.
with the numbers.
Right.
Now, American Indians, though, weren't counted.
Oh, okay. There was a category of American Indians called Indians not taxed who were mm-hmm. not to be counted. And the argument there was that Indians not taxed were not part of the United States of America, even if they might be resident within the borders of the 13 colonies or the 13 states at that point. What came to be called later in sort of common parlance, civilized Indians, in other words, Indians who owed their allegiance to the United States of America, they were counted.
Yeah. Well, has there always been an acknowledgement that did we always say something like, "Well, we're going to try to count everybody,"
oh, yeah.
but despite our best efforts, we're going to admit the fact that, well, actually, some people are going to slip through the cracks and they're not going to get counted.
Yes, and we also have also always admitted that we sometimes count some people twice.
Hmm. Is it there, particularly in the last couple of census? Well, I'm thinking particularly around the 2000
mm-hmm.
census. There was a lot of controversy, and
mm-hmm.
it became rather politicized about the issue of the undercount
mm-hmm.
and what could be done or should be done to try to get a better count. And I'm not quite sure to what extent that was an issue this time around. But I guess what I'm wondering is, Is the business of collecting the numbers more political today than it has been, or has it really always been political?
It's always been a very political issue because, in fact, what the function is designed to allocate political power among the states and then once in the redistricting process, allocate political power within the states in terms of all kinds of legislative districts. So there's always been controversies over, you know, which state is growing faster, which demographic segment of the population is growing faster or slower than another, and concerns about, you know, essentially the balancing process. I mean, the purpose of the census was that originally was that the framers understood that one of the problems with the British state was what was called then rotten boroughs. In other words, the British had no formal system for reallocating political representation among the constituencies in the House of Commons. And they essentially want to, and so if a, as cities were growing, especially in Britain at that time, the new cities weren't getting representation in the House. They wanted to avoid that. So they built this mechanism in. Now, they also knew that when they did that, that that would create political dilemmas for them. And if you, again, if you look at the congressional debates over reapportionment, which were quite lively well into the 20th century. Now we sort of have it on automatic pilot, but through most of the 19th century, the reapportionment debate every decade was quite a controversial issue, because it was at that point when they saw the results that they had to figure out, uh-oh, what are we going to do? Are we going to admit new states to the Union? What are we going to do about the fact that, say, a state like Illinois was growing much more rapidly than an older East Coast state like Massachusetts? Right? How are we going to handle this? And they did. You know, I mean, that, which is what, you know, most of my historical work has been about, which is, I mean, it's really a rather amazing story about, you know, about how we've done that this over 200 years.
Just very quickly to introduce again our guest, Margo Anderson. She's a professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is an historian who is interested particularly in the census, this counting that we do here in the United States every 10 years and have since 1790. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. What do we know now over the last couple of times we've done this about the undercount, about how many, do we have some sort of idea really how many people have been missed?
Right. Well, okay, the you know, as the Census Bureau will readily tell you, census takers going back to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington fussed over the undercount, and then, you know, you can find in their correspondence debate over gee, are we doing this properly? By the time you get you know, the problem with saying that was that until the 20th century, they didn't know how to actually measure it. In other words, they knew they could, they had anecdotal evidence, but they didn't have any kind of systematic way of measuring it. The invention of public opinion polling and probability sampling, which isn't until the 1930s and 1940s, finally provided them with a mechanism to cross-check the census results. So, and of course, it's the Census Bureau itself that originally makes use of that methodology and sort of says and sends out essentially a second survey saying what's called a post-enumeration survey saying, look, were you, you know, did we get you? And then going back and checking the census results against the sample. That allowed them, starting in the 1940s and 50s, to begin to make estimates of where and how and what worked and what didn't work. It also, for 40 or 50 years, led them to change methods, because they were discovering all sorts of other errors, including, so it was one of the reasons they went to self-enumeration. In other words, got rid of introduced the mail census in 1970, because they found that that it was a more efficient and accurate way of doing it. Now, all of that was sort of quiet, you know, scientific-type work until the Civil Rights Revolution and the Reapportionment Revolution of the 60s. What happened then is because there are the undercount is not only there but differential. In other words, certain geographies, demographic groups are systematically counted better or worse than others. It became a political issue over federal funds allocations, which are based on the census, and political districts, which are based on the census, where with big cities in particular saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we could have had a little piece more of a representative, or we should have had so many more federal dollars if they fixed this. That's what led to the controversy. And for 30 years, there was an argument about that was both political and methodological. In other words, can we do it? Should we do it? It did, as you say, come to a head in 2000. The results of 2000 actually were that there was an overcount, which most people don't, you know, are not that aware
really?
Of. Really? Yeah. In other words, the final evaluation results was that we, as I said, we double counted enough people to create an overcount, net overcount. And because the methodology that had been laid out to what was called adjust the census for error, net overcount and undercount, didn't work as well as the Census Bureau expected, they didn't use it. So the official count reported as of December 2000 stood. This decade, for a variety of reasons, first of all, the Republicans were never terribly interested in working on this problem, and essentially, although people are calling this an Obama census, it's really a Bush census, because all the planning and behind-the-scenes hard work that has to get done to set up a census was done between 2001 and 2009, January 2009. So essentially they didn't build in any really profound administrative changes that they would have taken to address it. Now, what they did instead was built a very large advertising campaign to try to raise public awareness and make sure people get counted, which is what you see now in the public. And that's what they're relying on for to make sure that they actually identify and capture everybody. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you about that just for a moment, because yeah. There has been this major effort, and it was fairly expensive. Mm-hmm. I think I saw it was $130 million mm-hmm. Was spent on advertising mm-hmm. to try to persuade people to fill out their forms and then mm-hmm. send them back, that it, as of the end of last month, 72%, I think that's the figure that I've seen, 72% of households did indeed send back their form, which is pretty much what it was 10 years ago.
Right.
So, and I guess yeah. Maybe you'd like to have 92%, but it doesn't really seem that $130 million that we spent really, at least compared to the last time around we did this, didn't really make much difference.
There's a lot of analysis to go on here, but, you know, as an initial number, it's not bad. And the reason it's not bad is because they're working against the fact that, postal mail is no longer the main communication source for business. You know, in this essentially, and it's been increasing that way. So the fact that in a very different technological environment, it looks like the 72% response. That's not bad, because they're working against the fact that most of us, you know, we now pay our bills online. We, we get our news online. We chat with one another online. So that wasn't the case in 2000, or certainly any decade before that.
One of the things that I have read, though, is that people apparently going into the census, there was some concern that the kind of anti-government sentiment that was going on now would lead some people not to participate.
Right.
And
right.
In fact, there were even some rather well-known and outspoken conservative commentators who mm-hmm. were saying, oh, this is government intrusion. You
right.
shouldn't give that information to the government. That all that kind of stuff that people worried about apparently didn't seemed not to have any impact on people's compliance with the census.
Well, don't forget there was a counter story. You know, that's what the census story. You know, mm-hmm. so there was a lot of commentary on all sides on this issue. By the way, every census going back to 1790, you find this kind of like, why are you doing this? What, you know, why is the government asking us this? You know, Americans are very, very concerned about their privacy and what their government is doing. And so they're naturally, and I think correctly so, suspicious of this. The way I usually, when someone asks me about this, I usually say, can you remember where you were on April 1st, 2000? And then I say, can you remember where you were on April 1st, 1990? And it's the fact that the event is so rare that means that we have to go through this sort of noisy process of arguing out among ourselves why we're doing this all over again every 10 years. I mean, we've done this 23 times. You know, we've got 44 presidents. So it's a relatively rare event. So the first thing you want to say is, well, yeah, this will come up. You know, you always expect it. The second is that the concern did not seem to bite as hard as certainly the Census Bureau was worried about, because they were, you know, they're the ones that have to spend lots of money, because they're responsible for actually reaching and identifying every single address that they sent a form to and finding out what happened to it. So if you don't fill out the form, what they do is they come after you, which is the phase we're in now. And that's expensive, very expensive. So they were, you know, they made the opposite argument, the fiscal argument, which is that if you just send this back, you save the federal treasury a good chunk of change.
Yeah.
So,
well, and I suppose that also argues for having spent the money on the ad campaign in the first place, because mm-hmm. if you can get people to fill out the form and put it in the mail and send it back that way, it's a whole lot cheaper than if yes. you have to send
right.
a census worker to somebody's house
right.
to knock on the door and say, hi, can I ask you a few questions?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's why, by the way, from 1790 through 1960, that's what the federal government did. They sent somebody to your door. Only in 1970 did they say, hey, we think we could do this by mail. So it's a, you know, the mail census is not, you know, has only been in the last 40 years. And the reason for that is because they didn't have maps. They didn't have an address system sufficient. Before that, you talk about efficiencies. Before that, the Census Bureau and the enumerators had to remap the country every decade.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Margo Anderson. She's professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We're talking about the census. She's written a lot about this and its history, and questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send your questions, comments to will-talk@illinois.edu for email. We have some callers here. We'll talk with somebody in Champaign. Line one, head up right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
Yeah. Was there ever a consideration that I've done some research, survey research and such, but there's a thing where you take the non-respondents, in other words, that other, 30% or whatever the mm-hmm. percentage, and then you take a sample of 30
yes.
that,
yeah.
and then you compare, and that works out pretty well. Was that a consideration, or has that been done?
Yes. It's been proposed. I mean, that was exactly what the Census Bureau proposed to do in the 1990s. And Newt Gingrich sued Bill Clinton over that because it was, you know, Gingrich was the Speaker of the House and Clinton was the President. And by the way, there's a, you know, because there's always a constitutional ambiguity between who really runs the census. It's designed to apportion Congress, but essentially it's administered by the administration in power. So they went to court over this, and the Supreme Court decided that what you're talking about, which was called non-response sampling for non-response follow-up, was was not allowed under the statute. And, you know, the statutory language that of Title 13, which is the Census Act. So they said, no, you can't use that for determining the counts to apportion seats among the states.
Okay, the next question is that I noticed on this one, and you know, you're talking about recalling 10 years ago. Well, that was, you know, that form. It seemed on this one that the issue was that they were trying to see how many people are living in a household, because it went on and on and on. I think maybe for some people it might have been sort of confusing. I'm not sure. Was that standard? Was that the same type of form that was used?
Yeah, the form, the 2000 form is the booklet, in other words,
right.
with lots of pages in it. Yes. I think that you're right. I think the 2000 form was a little bit shorter, and they got criticized that people ran out of space.
Okay.
In other words, if there were nine people in the household, or there was no place to put them, so people just stopped and sent in the form. This time, as you say, they asked a bunch of sort of framing questions at the front of the form saying, is there anybody else who usually lives here? And, you know, if so, give me their name and so forth. To try to deal with people who are, to deal with households that are, you know, in the language of statistics, sort of on the tails of the distribution, either very small, either very large households, or people who are not necessarily attached, firmly attached to the household.
Now, what about the form? Was that randomly for this detailed information, in other words, income, all that kind of thing?
There isn't any.
There wasn't this time at all?
No. No, none. No, this is the big change in 2010. What used to be called the long form, in other words, the questionnaire with all the very detailed questions about income and educational background and the language you spoke and disability and all that, has been moved to a ongoing rolling sample survey called the American Community Survey, which is in the field all the time. It aggregates up to about 3 million households. The goal is 3 million households a year.
What, do you think something's been lost?
Well, we're about to find out because the complaint about the long form, which was one that it was burdensome, that people didn't like filling it out because it was very, very long, and the other one was that, and so the data deteriorated. People just stopped, you know, halfway through and sent it in, and then they had the problem of an incomplete answers. And the other issue was that because when you collect that data only once a decade, by the end of the decade, it's very much out of date. And especially local governments and that use census data a lot for their sort of infrastructure planning, things like this, kept saying, can't you do something more frequent? And so this has been the solution. And if you go to the Census Bureau website and click on and look for the American Community Survey, you can now get up-to-date information on your local community that's much, much more recent, you know, well into the, I think we're up to 2008 reporting. Yeah, so in 2000, it's reported once a year.
Well, finally, what's the accuracy on that? Do you know? Do they know?
Well, because we've never done it yet in conjunction with a decennial census, in other words, this is... So the census itself is in some ways the gold standard because that they put a lot more effort in making sure they reach everybody. We won't know until the 2010 census results in, and we can actually match the numbers from the 2010 census with the numbers, say, on the age distribution of the population with the numbers that have been coming in on the American Community Survey, whether it all is going to work. And that's going to be... you'll start hearing the experts talking about that later this year and next year.
So we still don't really know, are we going to have, what sort of compliance issues are we going to have on that? Are we going to have the same problems where people are going to say, this is too much, it's too long, I don't have time for this?
But what I hear the internal people saying at the Census Bureau is because they use the same method. They basically send you a very long form by mail, and if you send it back, well and good. If you don't send it back, they call you up and say, please send it back. Mm-hmm. And if you don't send it back then, they send out an enumerator. And therefore, they've got a trained field staff who are really good at, you know, explaining to somebody why they're doing it and talking them through it and so forth. And so from what I'm hearing, the actual raw data they're getting is a little bit better than the long form.
Mm-hmm. And again, that just so people understand now, there will be a random sample of 3 million households pulled every year.
They're doing it now. It's been going since 2001.
Yeah. And the idea is that from here on out, I guess every 10 years everybody's going to get the short form, but every year then 3 million households are going to get this longer one.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Right.
Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. I use older censuses for family history research.
Uh-huh.
And was disappointed to see the this year's census because it leaves out a whole bunch of stuff that's very helpful for genealogy.
Yeah, for genealogy, yes.
And I wanted to point out to people that there's a 72-year privacy rule. So the most recent census that anyone can see the actual raw data from with the individual forms filled out by the census taker is 1930. Mm-hmm. And 1940 will be made publicly available in two more years, and then it needs to be indexed. When I first started doing this about 12 years ago, you had to go to an archive that had the microfilms, and then you had to hope that you were looking at a year that somebody had indexed. Now, a couple of commercial companies have done indexes for even up to the 1930 census. So, sometimes the indexers couldn't read the name right, so the index isn't correct, but it still makes it much more possible to find people. And with all the details, including things like where you were born, where your parents were born, helps you to trace the movements of family members. And it's really interesting. I really recommend to people, if they had family here in 1930, that you go to some place that has access to, like a library access. The Urbana Free Library has the library edition of Ancestry.com, so you don't need to pay to see these indexes online and the actual images. And it's kind of fun to see. They ask questions like, I think in 1930 they wanted to know if you had a radio. Mm-hmm. I mean, just little details like that sometimes come through, and it's interesting to see who all is in the household. It's very interesting. So one of the things that I think I should do for my family is make some notes that go beyond what the census says and do my own snapshot of the family, like, do we have a computer? Radio is no big deal. Do we have a computer? Is it a laptop? Is it a desktop? I can think of a bunch of different questions like that. That would be an interesting snapshot of where we are, and keep it with our family papers. So I suggest that other people might want to consider doing that as well.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And Professor Anderson, anything else you'd want to...
No, I mean, your caller is exactly right in the sense that the 1940 census will be made public in 2012, and there will be a cottage industry of researchers, both amateur and professional, who go to work on that. In other words, we have a rule that says you can't look at anybody's individual census response for 72 years, but you know, starting in 2012. You know, we'll be able. You know, every time we take a census 2 years later, we open up the one that's due to come. So it will be great fun at that point.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Margo Anderson, is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee, and has written a lot of things about the census. She's co-author of the book Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. Also, she's the editor of the Encyclopedia of the U.S. Census and has authored the book The American Census, A Social History. Questions welcome here. We're talking about the census, something about how it's done and why it's done and how people have thought about it over time. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to pick up on something that the caller said, because I think it is interesting, if you look over time at some of the questions that the census asked. For example, as she said, in 1930, one of the things they asked people was, do you have a radio? If you do that, do you see what sort of interesting things do you see over time, and what sorts of questions were people asked?
Well, the changes in the questionnaire are really interesting to look at over time. In other words, the changes in the possible answers that you can you can give to those questions. And what they do is they tend to track whatever the public policy debates are, in a fairly crude fashion, but nevertheless you can sort of see what's going on. The radio question, for example, is reflective of the emergence of that kind of that consumer product in the 1920s, and the sort of lightning speed with which it dispersed in the United States. In 1940 is the first year that we actually do a census of housing, as well as a census of population, and it's actually called a census of population and housing. Mm. the 19th century, most of the census was because most people were farmers or lived in rural areas. The agriculture census and the population census were almost coterminous. There were different questions for farmers, but they were done at the same time. That's no longer the case. So you can the disability questions, you know, about blindness and deafness and things like this, all go back into the early 19th century. And they sort of wax and wane over the years over whether the federal government either has enough room on the form or thinks they should ask it. Are the classifications for race and ethnicity or the questions about citizenship and nativity, all of these, again, are either more elaborate or less elaborate, depending on what's on the public agenda around the time of the census.
Mm-hmm. Just to pick up on some of the things that the caller said, I'm assuming that in the American Community Survey now, do they ask things like, do you have a computer in the house and do you have internet access,
right,
stuff like that?
Now the questionnaire determination process on the American Community Survey is a pretty, you know, is a process that goes on among the, you know, the agencies of what is called the federal statistical system. No questions ever go on a federal survey, and certainly the census, unless there's some public policy legislative function to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they, in other words, there has to be a reason for this. And the example I always use in this case is that there's always our lobbies every decade to put a question on, do you have a pet on the census?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have a dog or a cat or whatever? And it never goes on because the individuals who, you know, people who are asking it can't tie it to a particular either federal policy or piece of federal legislation. And in the same way, we never ask questions on anybody's religious identity because of the First Amendment to the Constitution and the separation of church and state. So the questionnaire determination process, you'd have to bore into the right now the American Community Survey staff and say to them, you know, when are you going to change the questions? And sometimes they do it because people don't understand or they won't answer, and or because there's new issues that need to be discussed. So commuting, obviously, questions on transportation and migration, where'd you live 5 years ago, and so forth. Those are all 20th century questions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have some other callers. Let's go to someone on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Hi. This is really an interesting conversation, and I'm going to ask a question you may have answered, but I'm just turning on the radio, and that is that isn't there somewhere else you can get information, you know, about race and ethnicity and age and gender, meaning that, I mean, in this society, every time you apply for anything, you have to give all of your, you know,
mm-hmm.
your statistics,
right,
and date of birth. And it was my understanding the government already has files on all of us. And
no.
That's what I'm wondering about. Well, let me just give you
a specific
example. Okay, here at the university, just in the last few days, we got a notice from the chancellor's office about, you know, classifying ourselves in terms of race and ethnicity. So we were all told to go online and check the appropriate boxes, you know. So, and I had already filled out my census form and sent it in, and so I'm thinking, well, why do the census and do this? And, you know, so the government is clearly already tracking the number of blacks and Latinos and people, you know, of various ethnic backgrounds. And so I'm just wondering if the census isn't superfluous at this point.
Well, you're asking a good question in the sense that and several other countries in the that used to take censuses have actually done what you're saying, which is begun to use what are called administrative records, in other words, other record-keeping systems, to do population counts. Right? France has done this, and the Netherlands and Germany. So certainly what you're suggesting is possible. The reason, frankly, that the United States hasn't, I think, moved along this, at least yet, is because of the way the census is embedded in the federal constitution, and it's very close tie to our political system. In other words, the people who will have to make a decision about this are the members of Congress, and so they will think not in terms of what you're doing in terms of efficiency and ease and perhaps, you know, cost,
mm-hmm.
but rather in terms of, am I going to lose my seat?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Because it's a because the fundamental purpose of the census is to count the population for apportionment and redistricting.
Right.
So the Census Bureau has actually had research working on this issue for the last 15, 20 years. And as you say, for certain elements of the population, they have very good coverage. For the Medicare population, certainly, it's the
okay.
case. Right?
Okay, I have one other quick yeah. related question. Okay, my daughter, for example, is in college in another town. She
right.
filled out her census form at that college town.
Right.
She's graduating this year. She's going to move back here.
Right.
And I did not include her on my count because that's what I was told. You know,
that's right.
Yeah.
You did
so
right.
now, doesn't that skew the records for people with college students? I mean, and suppose, for example, we as a family decide to move in 2 years. Doesn't that skew the number of people, you know, from one in particular?
Right. And yes, that's right. And the assumption is that there is somebody else who will replace you.
Oh, okay. Yes,
right.
We are all replaceable, aren't we?
In other words, that there will be somebody moving into your house or
yeah.
your, you know, and
yeah.
And as you say, this is a snapshot. We do this once a decade, and Americans move around, at staggeringly high rates.
Right.
So,
right.
And again, that's the decision has always been, well, should we do it more frequently or, you know, this is all we can afford. But you're exactly right. This is what the framers of the Constitution and the Congress has given us, and this is what we do with all the flaws. And you're right, as in places that have massive in-migration or out-migration,
right.
Louisiana is a good case right in point, the effect of
right,
Katrina.
Right, right,
Louisiana didn't lose any of its congressional seats after half the population of New Orleans left. They will, now they will.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank
All
you
right,
very
thanks.
Much.
Well, and isn't it also the case, Professor Anderson, that communities who think that there has been some sort of a big change
mm-hmm.
Can request a special census in an off year?
Yes, they can. They can. But it doesn't affect their legislative districts or their congressional.
But it would could well affect things that have to do with money,
mm-hmm.
with federal funding, for example.
Right. It depends on what the detailed language in the federal statute is, and what the reporting whether those numbers are based often on what are called the POP estimates, population estimates, rather than the raw census counts.
All right. Let's go to
which are done every year.
Champagne for another caller. This is line two. Hello.
Hi, I didn't tune in right away, so I don't know exactly what you've covered, but I've been working for the census this time around since a year ago February, so I've gotten a pretty good view of the operations. And right now I'm working for what's called census coverage measurement, which follows each operation of the decennial and is the mechanism by which the census can say, we're so-and-so many percent, we're accurate to within, 0.01 or 0.05 or whatever it is. And I wanted to speak to what a couple of other people have raised since I tuned in. One is the confidentiality extends to other agencies. So immigration, IRS, and so on, they have no access to census data until 72 years after the fact. So the U of I would be doing its own census of race because they wouldn't have access to that except in the aggregate from the census data. And as far as the countries that are doing things differently, I lived in Germany, and they have a national ID card. We don't. So there again, they have a way of accessing that information that we in the United States don't. And in the special census, there are three communities right here that have had special censuses in the last 30 years, Champaign, Urbana, and Savoy. So they do that because it affects the state money that they get and I think the federal money. So In Illinois, the rule is you only have to canvass the areas that are newly annexed or that you think have changed. I guess in other states you have to do the whole city, and that's not true here, so it makes it feasible here because the city has to pay for that.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, Professor, and again, Professor Anderson, I don't know if you want to comment on any of that.
No, that's exactly right.
We just have about 5 minutes here, and I appreciate the comment of the caller. I'd like to get back to something we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that, as I said, the last number I saw was as of the end of April, 72% of households had sent back their form, which was pretty much what it was 10 years ago, and that was in spite of the fact that some people were worried, well, would people say, oh, I'm not going to give this information to the government. What do they need to know this for? This, to me, raises this question, why people comply, why they do it, and whether, in fact, people really understand what this information is used for and perhaps why it would be in their interest for them to fill out the form and send it back.
I think people, you know, that there's a wide range of reasons people do it. Some people just are, you know, good citizens. I mean, you'll notice that the five or six states that are in the highest response rate are all in the upper Midwest, right? So there's obviously something in the water in this part of the country that makes people just sort of, you know, it just sort of it comes in the mail, you fill it out. In other cases, it's I think there's a lot of if the advertising campaign works properly, the political message does get out, which is this is about your local government and your participation, and it's a civic duty and so forth, and it's like voting. Most of us don't think about it very much because it's not a very onerous thing to do, and it's not meant to be.
There was something of a flap, and I wanted to ask you about this, regarding the Republican Party sending out a fundraising mailer to people
using census,
that's
mailers,
right.
Yeah.
And so it came up in Congress, mm-hmm. and the Congress said, no, you can't do this. You got to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested because I received one of these in the mail yesterday, and it still comes here. There's an envelope. There's mm-hmm. no return address. On the front, it says, do not destroy official document.
Yeah.
So you open this up. And it's a letter from my good personal friend, Michael Steele, who is the chairman of the Republican National
right.
Committee, urging me to support the Republican Party and basically to send them some money. And I was interested because I guess I thought the Congress said, no, you got to stop doing this. But they're still doing it.
Right. And I assume that there will be this will go right back. If this is not a random example, it'll come back up in Congress. There, as far as I understood, Congress passed a statute saying you can't do this and that there are sanctions to doing this. So we'll see what comes next. The problem of impersonating the census is also a very old one. You've got a male version, but again, the census officials have always had to worry about that. They also had to worry in the past about, in the 19th century, for example, about census enumerators who decided to, before the data was considered confidential, to make a little money by publishing it themselves in an almanac.
Hmm.
So there's always been, around the edges of the process, issues like this, and they're very similar to vote fraud issues. This is a very dispersed operation, and it's the United States is a very big country. But from my Olympian perspective on this, the interesting thing is that we managed to get it done, right? And that there are the fact that this went straight into Congress, and that they decided they didn't, they were very clear that this was not a good thing to do.
And do you now? Here we're essentially at a point where we have about a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done this now, and there will be now the periodic community survey, and then
American
again
the
yep. next big thing again. You know, maybe people won't really be thinking about this again until 2020. Do you think at that point if that we'll be doing anything dramatically differently than this time around?
I think actually that is what's going to happen this decade. There will be a big discussion over whether the postal system, delivery system, needs to be changed, and whether we need multiple modes of responding by internet or by phone or something. And that will lead to the discussion that one of your callers raised, which has to go through Congress, essentially. They have to sort of think through the implications of this. So there's both technical and political implications. I don't expect that will come up for a year or two. Before that, we're going to have a lot of fuss and bother about what the results mean. The census results come out in December. What is called the redistricting file, the data set that it goes to all the state legislatures to start redistricting their congressional and then state legislative and local government districts, that comes out next March, April. Then we're going to have a big discussion about, what does this mean? Who's going to win? Who's going to lose? Where are the seats going? Big winner is going to be Texas, as far as I can see.
Mm. Well, at that, we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Margot Anderson. She's a professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and has written a number of things about the census, including a book that she co-authored that was last revised and updated 2001, Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. She's also the editor of the Encyclopedia of the U.S. Census. And Professor Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring the exhibit Helen May Butler and Her Ladies, the New American Brass Band from the Smithsonian Institute. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
And coming up in the next part of Focus, we'll be talking about the American auto industry. Generally, very specifically, we'll be talking about General Motors and what has happened with that company over the last couple of years, particularly its bankruptcy in 2009. Our guest for the show will be Alex Taylor. He is a senior editor at Fortune magazine, and he is the author of a new book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is 60 to Zero. He says the collapse of GM was caused by bad management combined with ego and conceit. He says the company's executives preferred stability over change and GM's way over everybody else's. So more on that in the next part of Focus. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with the update on the commodity markets. Let's go right out to the pits. And as we do that, we can see that at the moment in Kansas City, July wheat is trading at 5.18¾, down 3/4. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, it's 5.08, down 1/4. May corn is at 3.61, down 3. July, 3.69, down 2¼. September, 3.75¼, down 2½. December, 3.82½, down 2¼. May soybeans, 9.45, down 1/2. July, 9.59½, up